Welcome back. Michael Warren Thomas here to discover the Finger Lakes, and there's been a bunch of sculptures showing up around the Finger Lakes in various spots, of a lot of them at wineries, and we're at Fox Run Vineyards this morning, pre-recording an interview with Scott Osborne and the sculptor Sam Kastner, who completed, installed a stunning gate just fairly recently, now maybe a year and a half ago. Time has flown by. And Scott Osborne, he and his wife Ruth, the owners of Fox Run Vineyards, how did a massive, multi-thousand pound steel gate appear at the front of Fox Run? How did this process get started when you started thinking about adding this kind of sculpture to the winery?
Well, I saw Sam's sculpture in front of Red Tail Ridge of the tree and the hawk and everything, which I thought was really fascinating. And I had been dreaming of a gate. You know, I just wanted a gate that, you know, because to me, an entrance into a place like a winery is sort of a given. And so I eventually called Sam and said, I'm interested in a gate. And he came by and we talked, and then he was gone for a month or two, and then he came back and he said, look at all these different types of gates that are all around. What piques your interest? And so we went through and we saw something with a pergola, and we go, oh, yeah, these are good. And then he comes back with this design, which was pretty fascinating, you know, with foxes and trees. And he said to me, so it's going to be 20 feet tall and 40 feet wide because, you know, we want to get a bus through or a truck. And I said, yeah, okay, that's cool. I have no idea what 20 feet tall and 40 feet wide actually means. And, you know, it took about another year, and he put the designs together and cardboard and paper and did all this kind of stuff. And one day he shows up and he pours these footers and 19 tons of cement in each footer. And I'm going, oh, that's really big. And then a couple of months later, he shows up and he puts up this one big pole. And I looked up and I said, oh, my wife's going to kill me. And because it was really tall. And then it started to...
That wasn't the flagpole.
No, that wasn't the flagpole. And so it sort of... Little pieces here and there, you know, the poles went up, then the pergola, and then one day he showed up with the gates, and it's a pretty amazing piece of sculpture. It's fascinating. Love it.
And it was actually closed for the first time recently, I think, or one of the first times for the recent snowstorm.
Yep. We haven't closed it because I want lights on it, and Sam's working on that. But we want to light it up, and I don't want to close it at night if there's no lights on it because I'm afraid somebody come driving in and wouldn't see it in time, and the gate.
Probably wouldn't hurt the gate, but it would hurt the car.
It would hurt the car, yeah. So, but that snowstorm came up, and I thought it was just a great time to close the gate for the first time, and
well, it's gorgeous, and it really, you know, the wineries of the Finger Lakes have some cool buildings. There's beautiful vineyards, gorgeous views, but there aren't too many entrances, really, per se. I think of, you know, like Mondavi has a gate at his place in California, and gates add gravitas.
Yeah, that's sort of how I felt about it, and you're right. There aren't a lot of gates, entryways. You know, there's just a driveway going up somewhere, which is there's nothing wrong with that. But for me, having an entrance, you know, gives a little more ambiance, and to me, it the customer actually might subconsciously feel something like when they go through a gate, they're going into a new world or new realm or something that's going to be different than what's going on out on that main road.
So how many photos have been taken of that gate so far, do you think?
I have no idea. This got tens of thousands. It's unbelievable. People pull over. You know, they'll drive by, they'll turn around, or they'll just screech to a stop. They'll get out, they'll go out, take pictures, and then head on down the road or even come in. It's fascinating.
Well, the sculptor behind this gate, which it is huge, Sam Kastner, also with us. And Sam, when Scott mentions a gate, what went through your mind? What were some of those initial maybe gates that you were thinking of around the world or around New York State?
So I initially, to me, the gate is the architecture, and every element in the gate is something grabbed from this property previously. So the pillars are representational of the round pillars on the front of this building. The pergola on the top is all around the entrance to this building, the tasting room. The maple trees, the fir trees, they're all right here. They exist on the property. And then the foxes are kind of a no-brainer. It's the company logo. So this joyful, sort of playful atmosphere that's created in steel captures a little bit of everything that was already here. And we just brought it to life on a much grander scale. So it's about 25 feet tall, and when the gates are open, 65 feet wide. Each half is about 5,000 to 6,000 pounds.
Which is, you know, again, as Scott was saying, I don't know what 30 feet wide is, and, you know, what's 5,000 or 6,000 pounds? That's like a big car.
Yeah, a couple Suburbans. Yeah, so... Yeah.
How do you move those kinds of things around? I mean, I think, you know, just constructing them is one thing, and then actually getting them here requires cranes and multiple forklifts.
So everything with Fox Run's gates to date was beyond my capacity. It was bigger than I'd ever done before. I didn't own cranes at the time, and borrowed neighbor's forklift helped us, thinking outside the box. You know, the gates themselves were oversized load to come down the highway, so we tipped them on an angle and put them on a real lowboy trailer. So taking back roads into account, we made it safely. we did what we could with what we had, and by far, that's the largest project I've ever made personally by myself. My previous experience, I worked with Albert Paley in Rochester, and my work doesn't even come close to scale with his work. So,
and I think maybe it was Scott showed me a photo of the Cincinnati Zoo. Is that gate? St. Louis gate?
Animals always at St. Louis. That was one of my first projects where I met Albert, his staff. I did not make any of the large-scale pieces, but I made a few of his models that travel around to various museums now for shows and exhibitions.
And what's your background then before you met Albert Paley and when you were thinking about becoming a sculptor?
So I didn't take an art class until my sophomore year at Alfred University. I was undecided. I was taking engineering classes, sciences. I took an elective, a ceramics elective, throwing on a wheel in the art building. And I came to kind of find myself that, you know, growing up a farmer with Carhartts and steel toe boots, there was a group of people on campus that still did that, and they weren't farmers. So I changed my major that semester. My parents supported me.
Winemakers wear Carhartts too, I think.
Yeah, well, it's all, you know, the agriculture in me. I didn't realize I had the very creative side because I'd never really used that in high school.
Fortunately, you went to Alfred because that's one of really amazing places around, what, the Northeast and the East Coast?
Yes. No, Alfred University it's an amazing school. When I was there, when I became an artist, I had already done most of my electives. So my final 2 years were all studio. So from woodworking, foundry work, metal fabricating, it was kind of overwhelming to just all of a sudden turn on your right brain and have access to world-class tools that I would never have, you know, seen before, even in high school.
Were you attracted to metal at that point?
I was attracted, one, to metal because of the instant gratification. You cut it, you shape it, you form it, you weld it, and you're done. And it, no matter what happens outside with the weather, it will still be there tomorrow.
What fascinates me about what you've done in the Finger Lakes, and we'll talk about some of the other ones, is the permanence of them. I mean, this gate, with that foundation, is going to be here for how long? How long is it going to last?
I don't believe you can put a timeline on it. You know, how long will the planet be here?
Right.
You know, it's not going anywhere. It would take you know, world type, world level disaster. You know, we don't have earthquakes here. We do get crazy weather, but we don't have tornadoes here.
An ice storm is just going to make it look even more beautiful for a while.
Yes, an ice storm would, you know, add to the glistening value of the stainless. Yeah.
So is that one of the things about metal that interests you, that not only is it instant gratification, but it's level of permanence?
Level of permanence and structural value. So if any of those elements were wood, they couldn't cantilever the way that I have the gates, you know, stretched out, 6,000 pounds stretched out on some hinges. It would be a completely different look if it were some form of wood gate.
Yeah, and so the hinges on this, you know, there's one thing to put up a sculpture, it doesn't move, but now you're putting up something that they might want to close occasionally. Where do you learn that kind of engineering?
Google is really good when looking into gates. Again, my past history with Albert Pele, everything he made was custom. So for a while, I was a project manager for him. And we would design things engineered overkill because it was Albert Pele, and everything is larger in his world.
But also, maybe each project is a different form of engineering, so you just, it becomes a process to handle a different problem?
Yes, it's very much a process from footers. I am not an engineer. But I've done enough of it, and I've been around it, you know, most of my career now, that it just kind of one project leads to another, and well, geez, this is how much concrete we used here, that was adequate. Let's move forward and do another big footer.
So, you've done, some people say you sort of started with Red Tail Ridge's sculpture. Was that your first large-scale one?
Red Tail Ridge was my first large-scale sculpture. I had just left Pele Studios. My wife was expecting our daughter Olivia, and it made sense to stay closer to home. I had a 3-hour round trip by the time I would, you know, leave my house in the morning and come back from Albert's shop at night, his new facility up in Gates. So when Nancy and Mike had reached out, the universe kind of opened up and everything sort of clicked into place. So
how did that design go in terms of what they initially proposed or were thinking about, and how you came up with that, the tree and the hawk in it?
So that was a few walks around the property with Nancy and Mike. The trees were evident. We wanted to get some sort of form of the logo, a red tail hawk, into the sculpture. They had saved all of the boulders, the rocks, from putting in the vineyards. They had pushed them to the edges of the hedgerows. So those were natural materials that we had to work with, and we had some form of signage going in. So being that they're far enough out of the state right-of-way, the sign is, I think, just over 20 feet long and about 4 feet tall. Where most, if you're in the right-of-way, I think you're, depending on zoning, you're limited to about a 4x8 sheet of plywood for some form of signage, 32 square feet. So as the design kind of happened, it was sketching, drawing, and then I work better with my hands in the studio, so I welded up a small miniature version of the Red Tail Ridge entrance sculpture. Upon seeing it, it fit their budget, and we just moved forward.
Well, a lot of photos have been taken of that too, and it's cool that it's so close to Fox Run, but you have with metal the different ways that it ages and what happens to the metal, and so in that case, you know, the tree works well with the metal rusts, and then the hawk is stainless.
Yes. Yep. The hawk is actually. At the time that the sculpture went in, they were very much following guidelines to be LEED certified for their new tasting room. So with the entire Red Tail Ridge sculpture, every element there was reused, recycled. The tree design specifically came from what all my area fabricators had left over in their stockpiles for tubing, heavy pipe, heavy walled pipe. So I took notes on what shops had what, and I, when I designed the model, it was all to scale with what I had available without having to buy new materials. The stainless from the Hawk was a wine tank that had been tipped over or bumped with a forklift, so it was no longer a functioning wine tank, but it was adequate materials to make my patterns with the for the bird. Stones were on the property, so it was just a matter of excavator, skid steer, dump truck to kind of move them around.
Largely downhill.
And it was all down. Yeah, gravity was very influential in getting those rocks downhill. A couple of them were probably the size of a Prius, so quite substantial.
I was thinking with the gate here at Fox Run, if you built your a temporary construction facility for the gate up the hill here, you could have just slid the gate down to its final destination here at the gates of Fox Run. Sam Kastner is with us, also Scott Osborne from Fox Run. And Sam, the other places you've worked, maybe give us a tour of where some of your other sculptures are. I've seen your work at Dr. Frank in their 1886 room, done some great signage and the tables, I think, and then Glenora, a really nice new and very different type of signage with water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Glenora was maybe two falls ago, and the entire design came from their logo is the ravine, the waterfall that is down below along Seneca Lake, and it has a trestle above it. So it's on all of their wine language, so they're bottling, T-shirts, hats, it's embroidered on their shirts, and we wanted to bring it to life 3D in Sam Kastner format. So every element in the entrance sculpture is directly digital from a photo from down on the down below the waterfall looking up at it.
And the waterfall's down where most people don't drive. It's down closer, much closer to the lake. It's private property.
Yes, yep. The waterfall is private property. I know that the owners are very open when wedding parties show up. There's probably some form of process to call ahead for to document how to get on the property.
People can call Glenora to check about that. And, of course, having some Glenora wine with your wedding probably isn't a bad idea either in that case. You also did some cool signage up for the Geneva Visitor Center. That's one of the more recent projects.
So before it was a visitor center, and now it's the Taste New York sort of location. So the City of Geneva and the Seneca Lake Wine Trail funded the replacing the existing signs that were there from maybe even the 70s or 80s. So we recycled the structure of that design came again from sustainably using the upright posts that were there holding the original signs. We severed them off, relocated their footers, and then built three very large stainless steel signs. So there's the Welcome to Geneva sign on the front. There's the Wine Trail sign that shows a map of all the wineries along Seneca Lake. And then the third component was sort of an educational lesson on Seneca Lake itself. So depths, quantities of water, the basic facts that as a tourist you might not realize when you walk around the end of the lake, you don't know just how big Seneca Lake really is.
And that, but you know how long it is. You have a super long sculpture that gives people a shape of the lake. And what's that made of?
So the top element of the entrance piece is stainless steel, and it's a 30-foot tall Seneca Lake, and it's literally the silhouette of the lake. So folks, when you're standing by I Heart New York, and you see a large expanse of water, it gives you just the basis for what the shape of the lake really is.
Standing there at the north end, you really can't see that far down the lake. You don't have a sense for how big it is. The sculptures, you need a trail. I mean, there's wine trails, there's cheese trails, there's a sweets trail in Cayuga County. There's has the Iron Vine is your studio name, right? Iron Vine Sculpture Trail arrived yet?
It exists physically. There is nothing digitally that puts it together. I'm a one-man show, so between the work that I have lined up for this year, for next year, catching up on work that I should be doing from last year, it's just it takes a team to kind of start moving in that direction, and I'm not at that point yet.
One of those kids will talk about the work you do with kids in schools. One of them can do it at some point. I think, and probably pretty easily put that together. So Scott Osborne is here, owner of Fox Run Vineyards. And Scott, the having a sort of a sculptural element, you know, art is part of what winemaking is about, right? And Peter Bell, your winemaker, is often posting some photos on Facebook of odd things in the winery that are artistic, are beautiful beyond the wine, and it seems like kind of a theme for him, and perhaps for you and Ruth also, that art and wine need to go together.
Well, that's very true, and you know, when you the way I look at the winery property and all that, you know, that each thing that you do to your property, whether it's the poles that are the, you know, go around the outside of the building, or the pergola, or the wisteria, you know, that's all part of an art piece. I mean, it really is. And I always believe that you should look at your property and look at where you live and, you know, make things that are nice, you know, to look at. And, you know, art is always nice to look at, depending on your view of that particular art. But, you know, I've always looked at, you know, I want to be able to get up in the morning and look around and be pleased by what I see, whether it's the sunrise coming up over the lake, or it's the green grass, or it's the trees the way they are. And, you know, so you'll notice I put up some maple trees that are along the edge of the driveway coming up. Well, that part of the idea of that is, and so when somebody drives through and those maple trees get tall enough, that there's going to be this sort of canopy that, you know, is a continuation of Sam's piece of art. And, you know, I just look at all of that as being a part of an everyday life, and that we should enjoy it.
And then sustainability, Fox Run, one of the early wineries to really invest in solar. So there's some big solar panels off to the side. People might not notice them when they come in, but they're not that far right from the winery itself.
Oh yeah, we've 100% of our electrical usage is generated by solar panels. Half of it is here on the farm, the other half is up in Geneva. And you know, I always say, you know, I want to leave the land and where I live in a better shape than when I got it. And so that's, you know, we've always worked towards that here. You know, we do little steps at a time. Trying to be sustainable and to be generous and giving to our environment.
When did you start here at Fox Run? What's the quick background of how Fox Run got launched?
Well, I bought it in 1994 from Larry and Adele Wildrick, and they had opened in 1990 and realized by 1992 it wasn't retirement. And I just happened to be single and looking at the time, and they gave me a call, and I was fortunate enough to find a partner and who was willing to back me on a crazy idea, because back in 1994, investing in the wine industry in the Finger Lakes was a crazy idea. And, you know, unless you were a farmer, you know.
You already had the vines, you already had the land.
Correct. So I was very lucky and very fortunate, and you know, having come out of the California wine industry and done a lot of in sales and distribution of wine, it was just sort of a perfect fit.
Why the Finger Lakes rather than Oregon, Washington, or somewhere else?
Well, when I came back from California to visit family and discovered cool climate wines, and the epiphany was, this was 1984, and I was, I'd gone around and I was tasting wines. There weren't a lot of wineries. There's probably 20 wineries in the whole Finger Lakes, you know, at that point. And, I stopped at Wagner's and I tasted a 1982 Wagner Chardonnay, which was one of the most incredible Chardonnays I'd ever had in my life. And
a cool climate Chardonnay.
Cool climate Chardonnay. And Robert Parker, it turned out a couple months later gave it like 95 points. But it all of a sudden opened up my eyes to what a cool climate wine was all about. And I felt that the Finger Lakes was probably the best place in the United States to make cool climate wine. So I packed up my bags, left Byron, and came back here to make wine.
And while the Finger Lakes has really evolved into a Riesling region, Fox Run hasn't given up Chardonnay as a major product. I had your Chardonnay out in British Columbia, Banff, out in the Canadian Rockies, Doyle Vineyard, Fox Run Chardonnay is on the wine list there, actually at a number of places. And so across the United States, in another country, Fox Run Chardonnay, and you're in other countries too, not just Canada, but Chardonnay is still something that you obviously believe in for the region.
Oh yeah. Well, I've always loved Chardonnay, good ones. And, it turns out my wife does too. That's her favorite wine to drink. And, so we've always focused on it. I hired Peter Bell and with Peter, I emphasize that, that Chardonnay was one of our passions here, and one of Peter's passions was Riesling. And so we focused on those two varieties to start out with. I have learned to drink Riesling and a lot. And, I'm fascinated in terms of Riesling being such an incredible, so versatile of a wine, but gotta have my Chardonnay every day.
And the thing that perhaps people who don't work in tasting rooms or work for wineries in the Finger Lakes, what they maybe don't realize are the visitors from around the world that come here. You've said in previous interviews I did with you that you've run into people from tastings you've done in Europe that for Fox Run that have now come to the winery. And again, having... When people hear about the Finger Lakes and come here from around the United States, around the world, having that gravitas of your gait, it helps. They'll send photos of it back to Europe, and as you said, with the winery building it step by step, we had to create the wines that we could sell in Europe. We had to create the wines that would attract world attention, and we need to build wineries that will impress people when they get here.
That's very true. But the other thing is we have to, as wineries here in the Finger Lakes, we have to start branching out and selling our wines in other states and in other countries. Because if people can get your wines in another country, they're going to drink them and they're going to write about them. And then they're also going to come visit. And, I think that the work that John Martini from Anthony Road and Chris Misick from Belangelo and I have done overseas, people are so impressed with the quality of wines that we're showing that, they go, oh my God, I never knew they could grow grapes in New York, because most people's vision of New York is Manhattan.
How many vineyards can you put in Central Park?
Yeah, exactly right. And that's a comment that's made a lot. But, it just opens up their eyes to the world of wine, and that it's just not California or Australia or New Zealand. And Europe, there's other places that are making stunning wines.
Yeah, well, and Fox Run's open 7 days a week all year long, right? And most wineries in the Finger Lakes really are. Not all of them, but most of them are open 7 days a week year round, except maybe Christmas Day, New Year's Day, possibly Easter.
Yeah, and Thanksgiving is always everybody's closed. But, as people have started to visit more and more, and, in the wintertime, our local consumer, in upstate New York can drive. They know how to drive in the winter, whether it's snowing or sleeting or whatever. They get in their cars and they go out. So if they want to go wine tasting, they're going to go. And we're starting to see, I mean, it benefits and it pays for us to be open in the wintertime because there are now enough wineries who are staying open that people are now coming down, spending, you know, the weekends or the week in the hotels in Geneva or Pinan or the Watkins Glen and going wine tasting in the winter because it's not as crowded.
And there are a lot more hotels than there were in 1994 when you first came here to Fox Run.
Oh, yeah. When there was just a couple of motels in Geneva and one or two in Pinan, and now there's four or five chain hotels in Geneva and four, I think, now three or four in Pinan. And so, you know, years ago, people would come in, a young couple would come into the winery and they would go, on a Friday, Mom decided to take care of the kids, you know, and so we're going to have our first date and go away for the weekend. Where should we stay? And on a Friday back then, I would say, well, you have to stay in Rochester because all the bed and breaks, there weren't enough bed and breakfasts or hotels to accommodate all the visitors, and they would say, well, we live in Rochester, and I go, then you're going home.
It wasn't Airbnb. You could have put them up at your house.
Yep. No, there was none of that going on. So it's been wonderful to watch over the last 25 years the way our region has changed, and we have incredible restaurants now all throughout the Finger Lakes that we never had 25 years ago. We have good hotels. We have lots of B&Bs. We now have this Airbnb thing. And so we're starting to see a lot of people from all over the world coming to the Finger Lakes.
And your restaurant voted number three best winery restaurant in the United States, USA Today, their 10best.com poll. So that also helps bring notoriety.
Oh, yeah. And you know, there were a number of Finger Lakes winery restaurants involved in that. FLX, they got number one. We got number three. I think Glenora got number 9, 10, or 11.
Ravines was 12, the Ravenous Kitchen. So there were four Finger Lakes winery restaurants on that list. And again, that was over a month of voting, people around the country voting. Some pretty big wine regions like California, they were represented. But one of the reasons we did so well in that, people are excited about this region.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, not only Bellhurst Castle got one of the best winery hotels, there's best tasting rooms, and we got number 7. What's going on here in the Finger Lakes is really exciting. And not only from a winery standpoint and a visitation and hotels and restaurants, but, you know, there's so much local produce, whether it's pigs or cows or deer or greens. I mean, all of this stuff is being produced down here and here in our region. And it's so, so good. And I try to encourage everybody to buy local, and not just buy local wines, but buy local produce, milk and ice cream. I mean, all of that stuff is absolutely fantastic.
Local sculptures, local gates.
Without a doubt, local sculpture.
One of the things with the gate at Fox Run that I don't know if you were thinking about, it didn't really strike me until I came down here and saw some snow on it. And that's the case with rain and the reflection of the sun. All of these elements and icicles and things that really change your gate and that sculpture that's at your entrance.
Oh, yeah. It's any kind of weather that's going on changes it, you know, and it's a different piece. When it has icicles coming down on it, or when it's raining and the streaks are going down the poles in a different manner, and it's amazing to look at.
What's going to happen in terms of lighting? You can do subtle, you can do not so subtle, you can do colors, you can do white, you can do muted, you can do from below, from above. You've got a structure on which you can put lighting and run wires, so there's really ton of possibilities.
That's why it's taken a couple of years to figure this out. The initial design, the trees, the foxes, the grasses on the gates, they're all hollow. So they were designed to have potentially lights put inside them for uplighting, which would, for instance, Red Tail Ridge, the tree and the hawk are solar powered. The solar panel sits back in the vineyard and it's LED lighting. So with the new technology of LEDs, basically every month you wait to buy LEDs, they get better. Better, brighter, change of color. So there's lots of options. I have a working scale model of the gate that I've been playing with, which is very easy to mimic any kind of light source from top, bottom, sides. I have some good ideas, and part of the lighting will be landscaping. The concrete footers are still genuinely exposed. We have plans for native grasses, New York State native grasses, some lights down on the ground, kind of uplighting, and then if it all goes smooth, the lights themselves will be in the gates, you know, lighting up some of the elements from the inside.
And when you design a gate like that, are you thinking about you know, the snow and the ice and all of these things that are going to impact it over the course of the year. You've been working with these kinds of outdoor sculptures long enough that that's an element you look forward to, maybe.
I definitely look forward to it. Living here in upstate New York the majority of my life, after college I'd moved to California for a stint where I was teaching, but moving back, I enjoy the seasons. And seeing the Gates, Red Tail Ridge, all these major elements, landmarks around the Finger Lakes, when driving by with my kids, I have four children, and when they stick their heads out the windows and scream, "My dad made that!" You know, there's 3 feet of snow on the ground. It adds a whole new element to lights and shadows. The weather is very much a part of our everyday lives, you know, from agriculture to the sculptures. And you know, when it rains, you know, 3D forms don't necessarily all get wet uniformly. So the streaking that Scott's talking about, it brings one more layer of animation to a lot of the elements in the Gates.
So, I mean, temperature can change the shape of metal. So do you have, like, future sculptures that will they'll change as the temperature, you know, goes from 5 degrees to 95 degrees. And it really, metal has so many possibilities with strength and shape and color, and it can move.
Yeah, most everything that I have built, the beauty of metal is it takes extreme temperatures to change its shape. So with certain elements, as in the tubular uprights, they're hollow volumes. If you're maybe an unskilled fabricator, you might forget to put holes in the bottom. So condensation. You remove a soda can from the refrigerator and it becomes wet. Same thing happens with anything that's hollow outside that's metal. Temperature changes, condensation builds up. The Gates, all four of the main uprights have major holes in the bottom, so all that water that builds up drains out. Otherwise, it would collect all season, all summer, fall, spring, and then come winter with minus cold temperatures. It would freeze and collect at the bottom and potentially destroy the elements. The structural integrity would be lost due to cracking or, I wouldn't say exploding, but it would be slow motion popping of those big structural elements.
So when you go see sculptures and Albert Paley's work and the things that you've worked on with him, but also some of his earlier pieces, is that kind of what you're looking at? Is part of it is the design elements for the future, for keeping it a permanent, and what kinds of elements have deteriorated at all, or, you know, the finishes, et cetera?
Very much so. The integrity of any of those pieces, there's a lot more to public art or sculpture in general than what the average viewer can notice. You know, someone with my skill set, it's how did they attach the pieces? Are there dissimilar metals touching each other where they're going to start corroding? You know, for instance, aluminum, if you were to put steel rivets into an aluminum canoe for a quick fix, it'd be quick for about a month, and then those steel rivets would corrode and your canoe would sink. So those are all the aspects of the metallurgy. Again, things that most people don't look at when they look at public art. You know, where are the holes? Where does the water come out if it's a big hollow form? Does that water, when it comes out, does it leave a trail? Is it part of the work? Some of Albert's larger pieces, he's known for very expansive ribbons, which may be copper or bronze, stainless. The way his core 10, which is the rusted element, might drip on something over time. It leaves a telltale trail after year of being outside. Those are all thought, all those shapes, when they're put together, that's already, it's someone at Albert's level or at my level, those are all pre-thought out as to this is going to leave a mark, and we want that.
Sam Kastner's with us, and you mentioned driving by some of the sculptures with your kids. You know, most parents, the work that they do is not something that their kids can see. You know, I guess here at the winery, kids can taste the wine that a winemaker's making, but For a lot of people, their jobs are just not visible, and yours are perfect that way. And not only your kids, but also it can inspire kids in some of the schools here. And you've been working with some schools and community groups to work on art, and what kinds of things are you doing with them? How's that evolving?
So past few years, I've been wanting to get back into education. Occasionally, I teach at Keuka College. I teach at Hobart in the studios, our local community center in Penn Yan, and a group called Elevate reached out after hearing about some of the class ideas I had, and I have offered a class from fourth and fifth graders up through high school students. We recently finished the fourth and fifth graders from the elementary school, and we're focusing on what's called the Idea Trail, and it's an art, public art trail on the community center property, and we're focusing our energies on animals from the Finger Lakes. So currently the fourth and fifth graders have come in. They've selected their favorite animals that they see in the wild here, and they've produced cardboard and paper models of those animals. As the class progresses, the middle school students and working with the high school students is a giant collaboration. We'll be taking those cardboard models and producing them with my help from my studio in metal. And the goal is to produce these animals in metal sculptures that are educational. So as you walk through the trail, you might find a brown bear. And there will be a plaque describing the biology, you know, how big they get, what they eat, maybe protocols if you see one in the wild, what to do, especially if it has, you know, baby cubs with it, herons, eagles.
I couldn't bring the bear spray I got out in the Canadian Rockies back on the airplane with me for the brown bears here. And with the museum, the Natural History, Cultural History Museum in Branchport, that also ties in with, again, educating people about, and educating kids about nature.
Yes, I work occasionally with the Finger Lakes Museum. I've done some awards for them. I've helped some fundraising. I collaborate with their their digital designers. They're putting on a Winterfest on Keuka Lake.
The Winterfest is at the Hampton Inn. I think it's the 22nd and 23rd, and they've got an ice boat on the poster for it. So I'm hoping to see some of those. I saw some video of some ice boats out recently on Keuka Lake.
Yeah, no, I'm an avid ice boater. I was intrigued a few years ago. A local gentleman, local doctor, said, "Hey, you should come try this." And he instantly had me addicted on his old Relic wooden DN. So I found another old Relic DN on Craigslist. And weather permitting, I really enjoy that adrenaline rush.
I bet you have some of the best blades on the lake.
I have very sharp blades on the lake, yes.
most ice boaters don't know metal the way you do, so it's some great blades. And so hopefully some of those will be out there again that February 22nd, 23rd in Penn Yan. And so, Sam, you know, one of the challenges, we have an old house in Rochester, is finding craftspeople to do the carpentry, to do any metal work, to, you know, all of these craft skills are being lost to older generations like Albert Paley's and others. And so introducing kids through art, through animals, to potential crafts and things that you're showing them that it's a livelihood potentially. It's not just, you know, not only art, but also a way to connect with the earth, connect with your hands and working with your hands.
Yeah, very much. As we've discussed here, you know, public art, any art, if it's outside, there's way more to it than just looking nice and, you know, whatever its aesthetic may be. You know, there's engineering, there's more hand skills than, well, I should say the tools that I use in my studio and or subcontract with local larger facilities are all the same tools, whether it's CNC laser cutting, machining. Those are all the same tools used for manufacturing. And one of my goals with this program is to engage students with tools that they're working with in their classroom settings that will enable them to do things with their right brain creatively. And once you can weld or use a chop saw or a circular saw, all of those things, all of those elements, they bring a sense of self-esteem to the table. You know, when you produce something and you make it, you know, when you're younger, you may draw something, you know, Valentine's Day is coming up and a lot of kids make their own Valentines. You know, that's self-esteem building. It's gratification, handmade. And I'm trying to engage that on a more commercial level. So as students are potentially building portfolios to advance to an art school or building resumes, working with me on various public pieces, they can understand the process more, which allows them to respect the process more.
Well, the classes that you do at Hobart or CUCA, are those just for those students, or can the general public sign up for those? Are they open to the community?
I would imagine they're open to the community. I've only ever taught students. I don't know the administration side of it. I taught sculpture at CUCA. I sit on the art advisory board at CUCA College, and I often help, for instance, say seniors with senior shows or students getting ready for field periods. The Fox Run Gates, I had two students from CUCA College work with me through the field period program. So they engaged college credits by being in my studio, and it helped them build their portfolios, self-esteem. It brought them to a whole new level in their just realizing what they were capable of.
And Pen Yan is turning into an artist community. There's Dan Mitchell, the national sales manager here at Fox Run, has a shop, the Staving Artist, right on Main Street in Pen Yan, and other artists work in that area. So he's working with wood, mainly wooden barrels, wooden barrel staves. But there's at least one, maybe several art shows in Pen Yan, and maybe a sort of art community that's developed there.
Yeah, there's our local Yates County Art Center. They're on Main Street, large gallery. They have a property between Pen Yan and Hammondsport, Sunny Point. I believe they've just put out something for this year's applicants for artists in residencies. So you get to stay in a cottage on CUCA Lake with a historic timber frame barn as your studio. Dan Mitchell, Staving Artist on Main Street. There's Refined on Main Street. Claudia Milroy, she has a bit of retail for sale. She offers classes to, for instance, I did a wine tasting there last night with Anthony Rode. Climbing Binds was there doing a tasting for their beers. And, you know, a dozen folks showed up to do various Valentine-oriented handmade crafts with her. So yes, as spring arrives and tourism shows back up again, Pen Yan is very much a hot spot for developing part of this art trail, public art and the creative side of things.
We've only talked about your really huge sculptures, but you also create some pieces that are a little easier for people to take home. The trees, those are gorgeous, and again, made of metal. Where are those available, and some of the other things that you make that people might want to, you know, bring home and use? That would look outside or inside, really, they'd work.
So I offer various elements from the Fox Run Gates right here in the tasting room. There's a small video that runs that shows the entire process of the design build. The foxes, the gates, the fir trees, the maple trees, those are all sort of candle holder scale. Anthony Road, neighbors just down the road, my family's winery, they carry some of the larger versions of the fir trees, as in 2 foot, 4 foot, 10 foot tall. I don't usually market my work very well because I'm often in the studio working, but those are all pieces that a lot of my clients are private commissions where I'll make herons or hawks or eagles, and the people really interested know how to find me.
All right, Iron Vine Studios. Follow him on Facebook. And you did when they redid the interior of the tasting room at Anthony Road, you did the metal tasting bars and the doors and things?
Yeah, so Anthony Road last winter was my last 2 years have been kind of big there. We completely redid the interior, all new paint, new ceiling paints. We added much needed acoustical treatments to the ceilings so people can hear each other better inside. We altered all of the doors to be sliding, kind of a more modern version of a barn door, sliding steel doors. Very austere landscaping this summer. Sorry, last summer we did sidewalks, parking lot lighting, following through with the same sustainability. I made each individual landscaping light. So it was all recycled steel, standard electric components, and it again, driving by at night completely changes the atmosphere when it's lit up. We've uplit all the large trees. Sidewalks are a lot safer. It's part of a 5-year plan to upgrade and just kind of modernize from where it started with Ann and John probably close to 30 years ago. So
another 19,000 tons of concrete for the sidewalks, right?
Yes. No, it was 400 to 500 linear feet of sidewalk. So it was a big undertaking. And then we did some fun elements with natural washed river rocks. So definitely new things coming this spring as well. Spring, summer, we're going to be focusing on the exterior more, lighting up more of the outdoor sculptures. We don't mow the fields around the tasting room because we're promoting milkweed and monarch butterflies. We're going to have trails through the fields, some seated areas so you can do wine cheese plates and just disappear into what we appreciate and kind of do every day anyway.
To bring you some monarch caterpillars next year, I've raised 150 monarchs from my little yard in the city the last 2 years with just milkweed on a city property, it's a fascinating process. So and we need more people to intentionally leave milkweed or plant it. It is a weed, so you know I have to pull it out of some parts of my garden, but it does keep the monarchs. It's the only thing that they'll eat. So glad to hear that. And of course Anthony Road has some phenomenal wines. Peter Beecraft doing a fantastic job with the wines. It's another winery. It's open 7 days a week. When I first went to Anthony Road, the Ann and John had the tasting room in that little shed that's, I think, still across the road. And very, very tiny place, yes, as you said, with an outhouse.
Yes, we're really going to start showing more and more of the history from large posters of historic, you know, Ann and John on the press deck when it was across the street. I think they still have some of the original tanks, maybe Bausch and Lomb they bought early on. They've been revamped a little bit to be more modern. But the goal is to kind of really show the history, the family connection. My wife, Liz, her sisters, her brother, they're all part owners, and they all take part in making it happen. You know, every day.
True family operation. And it's just I got to figure out the exact distance from Fox Run. I don't know, half a mile, mile, something like that. It's very close. 2 miles? It's very close. And again, winter, a beautiful time to come down and visit the wineries, do some tasting, and explore world-class wine country. Scott Osborne is with us. He and his wife, Ruth, the owners of Fox Run, and it's foxrunvineyards.com. Scott, thank you for investing in the region with the kind of sculpture you have as your gate now for Fox Run.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. Thanks to you for coming down all this way to talk to both Sam and I.
Great to catch you together, and Sam, I can't wait to see what's next, what's coming up in 2019. Any projects you can mention, or do we have to wait for them to show up?
So currently in my studio, I'm working on a very large dragon castle element for Seneca Shore Winery, which is about a mile from here, about a mile south. I will be doing a project for Herman Weimer. I've just met with Megan Frank from Dr. Frank's. I'm redoing their third tasting room. Last year was 1962, I believe. 1886 was the year before, and now we're working on the larger tasting room. It's getting a full makeover.
Well, it's an exciting time in this wine region, and great to have you putting your stamp on it. Again, Sam Kastner, Iron Vine Studios, thank you very much.
Thank you. This has been a pleasure.